Welcome to the next installment of the SUS News Podcast Series, where we interview newsmakers and discuss the news and applications relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your host, Patrick Egan, and this is the third part of a three-part interview with Andrew Shelley from Aviation Safety Management Systems. We conclude the discussion about his white paper, A Model of Human Harm from Falling Unmanned Aircraft Systems and Implications for UAS Regulation. Although I will say one thing I've noticed on my own is people that insure aircraft, you know, if something happens on a manned aircraft, you know, let's say a, 767 or something like that, you sneeze on it wrong, it's $1 million, you know. So the drone thing is like when you, oh, well, you know, it's a mishap and I hit a pole and it was $5,000. You're like, psh, that's peanuts, you know, that's nothing, man. That's walking around change. So
that is true, actually. The dollars involved, because often they are so small, they aren't probably doing the analysis. And wrapping it up as an aviation liability rather than some other category of liability, it certainly doesn't help there.
No. And you know, we'll just have to see how that comes out. And I, you know, as more insurance agency, or let's say underwriters or whatever companies get into the, let's say, drone insurance game, you know, we'll have to see. I think they're going to have to find their sea legs also. But I think they'll be the people that might have a hand on the tiller of that walk of excellence. But we'll have to see how that goes. Now, you know, moving forward, all of this that we've talked about, so, you know, we're building up to the crescendo here, is the micro-arc, okay? So that was the follow-on. And everyone's sitting around, and, you know, we've had reports, and we had people come and give, you know, talks about this at the expo and everything else. And, you know, the big takeaway was that the FAA was going to let the OEM self-certify that that their aircraft, the failures would, you know, 30% chance of serious injury on the AIS scale. And, God, it looks great. And this is fabulous. And we're going to be flying over people's heads in no time. And, golly gee, you know, it's a wonderful time to be in the drone business. Now, the way I looked at it, as the FAA has been getting beat up by our Congress because everybody and their dog is got a lobbyist in this drone thing, and Congress is just, you know, on the phone every day, you know, beating on the administrator, who's become like, this guy's done a 180. He's like the drone fanboy now. Oh, drones are great. And, you know, we've gone from do no harm to, you know, I want a drone of my own, or, you know, whatever, in this short period of time with no data to back up any of this stuff. So, you know, that's, I'm a little surprised. But anyway, you know, so they've been beating on them. You got to do something. Well, the FAA is sitting there. We're charged with safety of the NAS and safety of people on the ground and all that. How are we going to get out from the liability? Hey, I know what we'll do. We'll let the OEM self-certify and they can shoulder the liability. Your thoughts?
Well, two things there. The first is that as an economist, self-certification just never sounds like a good idea. The incentives are just so wrong. We think of, was it VW with trying to circumvent the emissions standards, and that wasn't even an issue with self-certification. If they're willing to do that to try and deceive the regulator who's doing tests, just imagine what the incentives are when you're self-certifying and there may not be a good regime in place to actually independently audit that self-certification.
Well, and you know, you're right there, you're preaching to the choir. And I made this, I do, you know, I hated Twitter at first, but I made this point on Twitter too. You're making my point. Now, same deal with the automatic car manufacturers. Oh, well, you know, we're going to let them self-certify that it's going to be safe, and you know, it's very hard to program or a robot to make decisions to run over the kids or the nuns, okay? And somebody else said the same thing. Well, what would be the incentive for, you know, letting this go? And I made the Volkswagen, you know. I mean, some people, I you know, maybe climate change, you know, you guys down there in the southern hemisphere had that hole in the ozone for a while. I don't know, is climate change a big thing down there in New Zealand?
Politically, it seems to be an increasingly big thing. But, you know, I'm intrigued that you mentioned the ozone hole, because we seem to have repaired the ozone hole, but unintended consequences seems to be a key factor in that. Apparently, one of the ways that we've repaired the ozone hole is by phasing out certain chemicals and replacing them with others which are much more ozone-friendly, but have an enormous global warming potential.
So that saying about the best laid plans of mice and men.
Absolutely. But now, to return to this liability issue, the other thing to balance the incentives, though, is the issue of product liability lawsuits. And throughout the English-speaking world, there seems to be a standard legal approach for damage caused by aircraft or anything falling from an aircraft is one of strict liability. So the operator of the aircraft has strict liability for any damage that they cause, and then there's the product liability suit that sits in behind that of actually we're looking to start looking back at the manufacturer. Are they providing something that's a safe product? So there is a balancing issue there of bad incentives on the one hand versus liability on the other. But from a safety perspective, you'd prefer that actually we put proper certification standards in the first place and didn't have the accidents that then led to the lawsuits, rather than just waiting for the lawsuits to sort it out.
Well, you can, you know, come play drums in my band anytime. That's all I could say, because you know, it's the same thing. You know, this is going to happen. The lawsuits are going to happen. And, you know, people are going to get hit with these things, and they are going to get sued. And, you know, maybe I'm some guy, I don't have insurance, but, you know, I'm living out of the back of my VW bus. You know, hey, man, I don't have any money. Well, they're going to go after the manufacturer and go, well, you know, I mean, I could see this one. I was calling it a... you know, this is going to be like a, you know, what are they called? Personal injury insurance jackpot.
You know? Absolutely.
Oh, well, you know, it says right here, you know, FAA self-certified, you self-certified, hit my client in the head. And especially if it's a company like Amazon or Google or somebody else like that, their descendants will still be disabled. You know, it's going to be multi-millions of dollars, and you're shouldering all of the liability yourself. So, my thinking on that one is okay, be careful what you wish for, because you have no direction at all. And that's not, and that isn't even how aviation works anyway. You know, you gotta tell the FAA, hey, you know, we gotta put together a standards group, we gotta get people in here, we gotta talk about, you know, what this means, some baseline definitions, so we have something to hit or targets to hit. So same deal with the self-certification. We're going to have to see what comes out in the NPRM, but your interpretation of what that may mean might be different than my interpretation, depending upon what the standards look like. And you would agree with that, or do you disagree with that?
Oh, absolutely agree with that. One of the things I haven't mentioned about my background is that so my company, there's just the two of us, but we also do a bit of safety auditing in the non-aviation world. And even when you're presented with an audit standard so that we can audit against that, the interpretations that different auditors have as to are you meeting the requirement of that standard can be quite significantly different. We've turned up to do audits where the client has previously passed at the highest level from a different auditor, and it's time for a new audit to ensure they're still compliant, and we can't see how they could possibly have passed, and so you're going to get this sort of issue as well. Even if you've got an audit standard or a certification standard which looks clear, you have different levels of interpretation depending on the person and the level of experience and knowledge they've got in that area.
And I totally agree with you. You know, it's kind of like, you know, there's a software certification for software for aviation, and it's called, there's a DO-178, and there's different variations. And, you know, I've talked to people about this before, because we've talked about the open source software that was never going to work, and it seems like I'm going to be right about that one again. We've got all kinds of stuff. But anyway, the DO-178 is a very rigorous certification process where, you know, the cost estimates are for just, this isn't development and validation, this is just testing at the end of the day, is $10 a line of code. Okay. And I've asked some of the manufacturers, and I asked one guy, I go, well, how many lines of code do you have? And he says, well, we've got four very long ones. But that, you know, was a great answer. I was like, that's a good one. I like that. But, you know, in reality, that's going to be millions of dollars to certify code. A lot of the people in the drone world, especially here in Northern California, are software people. And, you know, you just go keep working on your software because it's, we're thinking about it like a cell phone app. A cell phone app is much different as far as, like, you know, let's say certified software that you would use in any aviation. You know, you're going to have partitions that are certified. If your air, you know, your autopilot software interacts with the sensor software, well, that's going to need to be certified. It's just like a gift that just keeps on giving. And my thing is, if you don't play your cards right in the beginning, when the cheap dollars are being spent, you're going to come back and you're going to have to spend the very expensive money to, let's say, fix the potholes that you made because you were naive. Agree, disagree?
Oh, absolutely agree. You mentioned cell phone apps. The other model that comes to mind is Microsoft. When was the last time that you had a product released from Microsoft that people trusted and that the new release would be bug-free? You know, it's let's build it, see what breaks, and then we'll sort of fix it on the fly.
Well, that's funny you say that.
Software development model.
Well, that's funny you say that because, you know, there's several things. I mean, I was in around during the dot-bomb, and, I, you know, I couldn't believe what was going on then. And it was just, you know, wasn't gonna work. But then, you know, the funny thing with the Windows thing is I gave up on that with Vista, where you had to pay money to downgrade your operating system. I'm out, you know, at that point. I'm done. It was nice knowing you. Have a nice day, you know. So it's funny that you mention that, but because it is kind of true. And some people just kind of put up with that. Now, the other on that one is kind of funny is, you know, you may have heard about that down there where Google, you know, bought Boston Dynamics, and, you know, they're making these great robots that are quadrupeds and bipedal.
Bipeds, yeah.
And they're, you know, hey, we want you guys to make a commercially viable product. Oh, God, I'd have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that meeting. I'm sure it was flying back and forth. You know, look, you know, you guys couldn't really even handle the Google Plus thing, man, and you're telling us how to, like, you know, do robots, bipedal robots. Have a nice day. I'm sure it was bad. I'm sure it got very, let's say the language got very colorful during that meeting. But, you know, I mean, a lot of people, they look at this, all this technology. Oh, it's just software. I don't want to invest in hardware. Hardware's too hard. Oh, man, you know, it costs a lot of money. There's this model where you have these kids writing code and you're just shoving pizzas under the door, you know. They'll come out 30 days with a, you know, cell phone app that, you know, has its own emoji, you know, I don't know, whatever. But you know what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. It must be, I'd love to know what software development process Elon Musk is using at Tesla. Because their model seems to be somewhat more robust than what software development normally is. I know someone here in New Zealand who spent the dollars to import a Tesla, and he's just wrapped with the way that when he gets a software upgrade, it's guaranteed. It's been tested and it works. It's not a software upgrade that's going to introduce a set of bugs that nobody realized existed, but actually it's been properly tested. So whatever he's doing it right, and that would be good to see.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for that. You know, the day is coming. I'm sure it's coming. But it's funny that you mention that because, you know, he has the autopilot, right? And they have some comical, like, you know, they have ludicrous speed and some other stuff. They have the autopilot. And I don't know if, you know, how many are down there in New Zealand. However, you had people up here on in the States and on YouTube, and they're in the back seat with the autopilot on, filming it with their camera. I do not believe that, you know, hey, let's we're going to come up with this autopilot thing. And, you know, the idea is you could take a nap in the back seat. I do not believe that was like, you know, the meeting with the whiteboard. Let's get together and brainstorm what we're doing over here. You know, we have had a couple of accidents. You know, right now, I would say that they're self-certifying. If we have a rash of accidents, self-certification's going out the window. Agree? Disagree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And to be fair, I think people are there. This is it. People do dumb things as well. People are taking the opportunity to use the product outside of the bounds that it's intended to be used. At the moment, it's supposed to be helping you reduce your potential for an accident while you're sitting in the driver's seat.
Right.
It's not supposed to be letting you have a nap in the back seat.
Exactly. Well, and then, you know, it brings up so many other things. And I did have a guy on the podcast who was a engineering fellow at Stanford and also a law fellow at Stanford. And I was like, geez, no social life over there, huh? But he's talking about, you know, the automatic car thing. And we were talking about that liability, you know. I mean, you know, I'm behind the wheel. I'm having a sandwich. And, you know, the car, you know, runs Granny Smith over, you know. I mean, who's liable? I mean, I'm technically like the systems operator. Should I be watching? You know, is it the manufacturer of the car? Is it the person that made the software? Well, here in the United States, the lawyers call it taking the big bite of the apple and you just sue everyone, you know, and see what you can make stick. So, well, you know, we're going to have to see how this turns out. The other thing I think is kind of funny here in Northern California is you have these different companies that are doing their automatic cars. And when there are accidents, nobody's like, oh, you know, they try to keep it under wraps. Even the Stanford has an Audi. I went to the robotics block party a couple years ago, and they had these fabulous SOPs for using the espresso machine, which I wish I would have snapped a picture because it was like three pages. It was great. But I did notice that the Stanford Audi had a tuft of grass in the air dam. You know, no. Where did the tuft of grass come from? You know, I was preoccupied with other things. I would have liked to chase that down, but I thought that was funny and I should have got a picture of that too, but I didn't. But, you know, these systems aren't perfect. You are right. People do stupid things and people do things with other things that are stupid, you know? So we'll have to see how that all shakes out.
Well, and this brings us back to manned aviation and the software development standards there too. We've had aircraft that are capable of taking off and landing themselves since the 1960s, I think it is. Mm-hmm. The Boeing 777 can land itself. The software and the systems are good enough to do that. And I think here in New Zealand, each Boeing 777 has to do a self-landing once a month in order to remain certified that it's capable of doing that. But then we still have pilots on board, and we have pilots on board for a reason. No matter how good the software is, it does fail. And only a couple of years ago, I forget when exactly, the FAA put out an alert to air transport operators that it wanted to see pilots getting more hands-on stick time and not relying on the autopilot, because if an emergency occurred, they needed to have the skills that were good enough to be able to fly the aircraft and not be so rusty because all they'd been doing is sitting there watching the autopilot.
Exactly. And that was kind of, you know, if you look at that, we had that accident in San Francisco with the Ariana flight a few years ago. And the guy that was over there in the right seat, like, had almost no time, you know?
Yeah.
So they were relaxing the standards. Now, you know, people talk about that. Oh, we're going to see the day when there's, you know, no pilot in the cockpit. I don't know. I still want one guy up there. Now, in the old days, you know, when they had the commercial airlines, you had like, you know, you had an engineer in there and you had a pilot and a co-pilot, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the crew has started to shrink. And I think you might have a situation where you have a person there by himself in our lifetimes, whatever else. But I think you're going to still want somebody on board that's a systems manager. And, you know, everything goes south, so to speak. The guy hopefully has the skill set to bring the bird in manually, you know. Because I look at technology, and I love technology. You probably love technology. We all love technology. And it's great when it works.
Absolutely.
When it's not working, it's not so bueno. But, you know, the rest of the time, it's good. So, you know, one other thing is, you know, I wanted to talk about mitigators. And even this morning, I had a conversation with a guy. You know, I fly my unmanned aircraft with prop guards. People say, oh, prop guards. Oh, God. You know, they degrade the performance. And, oh, they're this and they're that. And I'm like, you know what? The effect is minimal. And the added safety that I get from a quality prop guard, if it hits someone, you know, they're not going to get hit by the prop, hopefully, or that, let's say, is reduced, that risk is reduced. It's worth it to me to spend the money. I got a pair out of Germany. They were $200, okay? But they're stiff. They work. And it's worth it to me. The peace of mind is worth it to me. So that might be one mitigator. Another mitigator might be a parachute. And I noticed that you referenced Fruity Shoots. And I know Gene. And Gene's come and spoke at the expo and demonstrated his products and everything else. And the parachutes, I think, is a good idea as a mitigator. But could we, like, you know, let's say put all of our eggs into that basket as a mitigator for unmanned aircraft causing injury?
I think they're absolutely marvelous for a particular type of mitigation. So if you're going to be flying at 200 feet and you have some sort of failure that results in your machine plummeting to the earth, that's the ideal time to be activating a parachute. Slow it down to a velocity that where if it hits someone, the kinetic energy is not going to be enough to harm them. And that's the perfect situation for them, and particularly for a multi-rotor machine. There may be situations where they're relevant for fixed wings, but usually a fixed wing, you're going to be able to pilot it so that it can glide to a safe landing area. So I think used in context, they're absolutely marvelous for mitigating that particular risk. But as you say, if you're flying close to people, prop guards are, again, they seem to be a no-brainer. Why would you not have a prop guard when you're flying close to people? Our flight control software is certainly not fail-safe. Our pilots aren't fail-safe. When you're operating at a distance, you can misjudge where two objects are in relation to each other in three dimensions. It just makes sense to have those prop guards on. They're cheap and they can avoid injury.
Exactly. So, yeah, we're in agreement there. And I do, you know, like you just said, there are, depending upon where you're going to operate and what you're going to do, say you're doing the high-power transmission lines or high-voltage whatever, hey, okay, it's a fixed wing, you got a parachute on it, you have a failure, it comes down. You know, that might make sense. So, you know, we'll have to see what comes up in the future. But I do think that the OEMs unwittingly grabbed the tiger by the tail with this self-certification thing. That would be one of my conclusions from all of this. And we'll see how that plays out. But I don't know that it was well thought out. So, you know, we've been chatting for a while. This is a great conversation. I'll probably have to break this up into multiple podcasts. But, you know, maybe you could tell me some of the conclusions that you came to, you know, doing the paper, the micro arc after that, and where we're kind of headed into the future.
Well, the first conclusion, which is one that's not written in the paper, is that policy is a political process, And so policymakers are usually highly focused on achieving consensus by hook or by crook. But consensus without proper analysis is really meaningless. So we've talked about a lot of things today around that, of perhaps a number of those on MicroArc being railroaded into a position they didn't understand, and how there's some significant liability issues out there that they might not understand. And this would have been a lot clearer if there'd been proper analysis conducted. And the lack of analysis hasn't made those issues go away.
I'd concur with all of that. I mean, you know, there is, like I said, I mean, obviously there's, when they launch these, there's obviously a end goal that they are trying to meet, and we do have to get there by hook or by crook. My thing is I'm one of these guys, I mean, I'm not an engineer. However, I understand that there's this, you know, scientific process, something that's repeatable, and, you know, you can go out there and try and, you know, collect some data. I'm into replicable data collection. I'm not a real big fan of the models and things like that. But if you're going to go into something like this, and we didn't even get into the AIS scale, but that was another question I asked. You know, did you have a medical doctor on the MicroArc to represent, you know, or tell you what these things would be, or what this you know, what these serious injuries could be, you know? Now, we didn't have anybody. So who made the call? Well, you know, we just had to wing it. That, in my estimation, is not a good way to make policy.
They'd have done a better job if they'd actually spent a bit of time on YouTube looking at some of the injuries.
Well, maybe next time that's what we'll have to do. You know, the other one that cracks me up is that people just keep throwing this bird thing in there. You know, oh, well, there's millions of birds, and oh, planes hit the birds, and, you know, yeah, okay, but the bird, you know, doesn't have, he's organic. When organic matter hits something, usually it tends to liquefy, okay?
Yes.
Metal, not so much, you know, that's one thing. The other thing is the bird's kind of organic. He's out there. He doesn't know any better, you know. Hey, oh, there's a bug. You know, I'm going to go out there and get the bug. And he's not really, let's say, you know, most species of birds aren't as together or have a wherewithal or self-awareness that humans have. He may try to survive. But hey, you know what? He doesn't really understand what this plane is or whatever, and he gets hit. But you can't go back and sue him later or his family, you know?
That's right.
So it's a totally different thing. And then I hear these other ones where people are like, well, that's why these airliners have multiple engines. So if you, you know, ingest one of these drones, yes, it's going to shell the motor, but you have another one. And I'm like, oh, God, please do not say that anywhere.
Oh, look, this one is particularly interesting. There was two things that happened last year which sort of put the lie to this whole argument of, oh, it doesn't matter, we've got engines are designed to self-contain a failure and that sort of thing. So the first one was that one of those engineering schools did a marvelous numerical simulation of what would happen when a small UAV hits a turbine engine. It wasn't pretty at all, and it wasn't just that it would strip out turbine blades and the engine would shut down. It actually was a complete uncontained engine failure where the casing of the engine gets ripped apart by turbine blades and they go into the wing. And then around about the same time, you might recall there was a Boeing 777 that caught fire. I can't remember the details just off the top of my head, but at one of your airports over there was a Boeing 777 that had an engine failure and it caught fire on the runway. Something hit. It appears that something actually hit the engine while it was at less than full speed, and that's when it's most vulnerable. And it did exactly what this numerical simulation predicted. Turbine blades broke. The engine is supposed to be designed to withstand that, but it still had an uncontained engine failure. The blades pierce the wings. The wings are full of fuel, and the next thing you've got this great big fire. It was quite convenient that the aircraft was still on the ground. But if that had been in the air at say 1,000 feet, and that happens because someone flies their drone in the wrong place, the results could be disastrous.
Exactly. And even that, and you know, I tell people, please don't mention this near any FAA people, NTSB people, or anybody from the airline pilots, you know. Because the thing is I'm sure you've flown a commercial airliner, you know. And the thing is I've told people, I mean, if there's turbulence, I would even call it severe turbulence, people start going a little, you know, they get edgy. You know, and a captain's going to come on, don't pay attention to that fire out on the port wing. It's okay. Have another bag of peanuts. You know, it's going to be pandemonium, man, on the plane. So my thing is, it goes back to what I was saying before. There are certain places where drones should not be. And even as an industry, I've done a little of the Jiminy Cricket. Jiminy Cricket. Well, nobody liked that guy in Pinocchio. Jeez, he was a wet blanket. But, you know, hey, man, don't be showing videos to people where they're flying at, you know, Mexico City Airport. Oh, well, they had the authority and they had a disclaimer. Yeah, they had a disclaimer, but, you know, 1 million people downloaded that. How many of those 1 million people do you think read that disclaimer? Probably two, okay? It's an exaggeration, of course, because I can't qualify that, but my point with that is how many people are like, you know what? I'm getting my drone. I'm going to go down and I'm going to get some cool footage like that. Don't be an ass, you know? Try to be a little smarter than that. And some people, they don't care. This is another thing that we've got going on in the United States. I don't know if so much in New Zealand, but there's like this cult of personality thing, you know? I want to be the drone guy, you know? I joke about how I'm a drone expert because I have drone in my Twitter handle. That's all you need to know, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, so and it works, you know? I can go places and tell people I'm an expert, but I tell people I'm actually an aspiring drone expert because there are people that are more knowledgeable than I am on all of the different subjects. I am not an across-the-board expert. I know people that are, but not me. Anyway, you know, why don't you, if you could, I mean, you said you had a business. Could you give us your website?
Okay, so the website is www.asms.co.nz. So the company name is Aviation Safety Management Systems Limited. So that's the one that focuses on all the aviation related issues and material. And we've got a few things on there. There's a publications section which has got a few interesting bits and pieces in there as well, including perhaps a personal rant about the cult of airport security.
Yeah, boy, that's a whole nother show right there.
Oh, it is. It is.
You know, now another question, you know, just a little bit of a side note, but I did notice that in your paper you referenced some work that Reese Clothier did. Do you know Reese?
No. Now, what work was that? Just refresh.
There was a reference in the paper, your paper, but it was a study that was done. He's actually in Australia working there, but he's actually from New Zealand. I was just wondering if you knew him. Good guy. He's written some other good reports, which I will share with you offline. And really, there's some of the only other reports that I've seen that even kind of reference any kind of science. But he was up here in California. And he was at NASA Ames for a while, and I did get to meet with him and talk with him. Good guy. But that's another thing I want to do is if you ever get up here to Northern California, I don't know if you ever make it up here, you're invited, you know, I'd buy you a nice Mexican dinner, cold cerveza, and or, you know, if you're up here at the right time of year, I'd like to invite you to come and speak at the Small Unmanned Systems Business Expo, which is first week of May.
First week of May, wow. Okay, well, we'll actually have to bear that in mind. We've got now invitations for the two coasts. We've got an invitation for any time you're in New York, just last week. We must make a trip of it.
Yeah, most definitely. So that offer stands, you know, just think about it if you're ever here. I do think that the work you did was good. You know, I didn't know you or didn't know any of your positions or your work prior to me belly aching about the poor performance of the representatives of both on the task force and the micro arc. But I did like what you came up with, and I agreed with a lot of it. I mean, we didn't agree on everything 100%, and that's okay, because that's the beauty of having a free and open conversation, is we don't have to agree on everything, and different points of view, which I think are good. So I enjoyed our conversation. I'm going to have to probably split this into three shows. It was really good and enlightening. And, you know, anytime you ever, if you come up with other papers or other ideas or even articles or whatever, please share them with us, and we'd love to share them on the SUS News.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you very much, Patrick. I have a couple of others that I'm working on. Actually, it's still related to unmanned aircraft, but on privacy and trespass type issues. So another thorny subject there that...
Yes, but they're relevant subjects. So, yeah, we'd love to see those. And, you know, when you get them done, send them over.
I'll do that.
Well, thank you again, sir. It was very nice meeting you, and we appreciate you taking the time.